G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Whitey, good morning.
Good morning, Daniel. I've spent a lot of time with Merv over the last 6 weeks. He's so much fun to be around, so I'm really looking forward to having a chat to him. He's a bit reluctant to talk about himself until he gets going, and then he's away running.
So, we'll just bowl one outside off-style half volley. Let's see what he's got for us with that big county in hand. Just pound it back over our heads.
Yes. Might be surprised that I spent a lot of time talking to him, not just about cricket, but predominantly about weight loss.
And, is that right? Well, he's on the man shake. He's on one of those shakes.
Well, that's right. So he's a bit like me. He's tried everything. But he's probably tried more than me. In fact, he has tried more than me because he went into the jungle.
He
lost 17 kilos in the jungle.
17 kilos?
Yep. He went on that. There was that other show he went, like Celebrity Overhaul or whatever it was called. He went on that as well. So he has tried more things than me. He's probably been as unsuccessful as me as well. So
I probably won't open with that. I might let him tell a few stories before I throw that at him.
Anyway, I'm looking forward to chatting to Merv. That'll be great fun. I'm a bit concerned about your players getting ahead of themselves.
What are you talking about?
There was a quote in the paper this morning from one of your players.
Yeah.
Your players, Taylor Harris.
Yes. What's Taylor
say? She says, "We've come back and we're dangerous."
Fantastic. Fantastic.
So what... Explain to me, Daniel, as coach of the AFLW team, what's dangerous?
Well, it's clearly not my word, but I imagine we're looking pretty good, is what Tay said yesterday at the press conference. Dangerous, good team, back in shape, but dangerous. And don't pretend we're not, Whitey. I know you're sitting there and you've had a look at the markets and you want to see what's happening there at tab.com.au. We're dangerous. That's what Tay said. If Tay's thinking we're dangerous, I'm happy with that. I'm very happy with them.
So it got me thinking, because I haven't really spoken to you much about the AFLW program in recent weeks. It wasn't sort of high on my agenda. But I was interested in talking to you about, now you are back, how different is it because of the obvious things around COVID and all that sort of thing? How different is it to normal, and how compromised is it or isn't it? Is it pretty much as it was last year? How would you describe the last few weeks?
No, it's different because of the way that you have to operate with your COVID environment. And this is for all sporting teams out there. You know it through even local cricket, that there's the 10 over or 20 over clean the hands and clean the ball rule going on.
It's enough
on
to
over
not play, to be honest.
It's 2 minutes of your day. You'll be fine. But we've got to train in small groups. And so for now, at the moment, we've got two out of the three sessions we can train as a full team with contact. So that component of it is quite normal. But still, the girls are in different parts of the facility, of the ground, getting changed in three different areas, because you're not allowed to have a certain number of people in a small confined space, so they all change in different areas. So we have two sessions where we're training all together, like a normal session, effectively, but we don't prepare in the same areas. And then there's the one session which is unusual when you think about it. You've got two out of the three, you're out there as a group, full contact training, and you're allowed to do that. But the third night, you have to separate into your groups, three groups of 10, and then you're in a rotation of drills and stuff through that time, through weights and skills and craft and all sort of stuff. So that's the only real difference from a footy perspective. The other parts are about operational procedures, about where you change and how many players and you can have in an area at any given time. Meetings, you can't really have a team meeting because you can't have the players in the one area. So you're doing that in shorter bursts in different roles. So that's the difference. I think far off being normal, though, in the grand scheme of things.
So you're talking about a team meeting. Could you wheel a whiteboard out onto the ground and have everyone sit down outside and have a meeting?
Yep, but we'd have to separate, have a distance between each group that are out there. Like you have your spatial distancing or social distancing within the group, and then, of course, separate the groups from the other groups. So it's still a bit of a pain. We have done that, but we can just do it individually with the groups. It's okay. It's all right. It's all part of the process. So it's a little bit different, but it's coming together pretty well. And hopefully, sooner rather than later, we get back to regulation proceedings for everyone, let alone what we're doing in the footy world. Mm. But for everyone, you might be able to get through a game of cricket without sanitising your hand halfway through whiting.
Well, there was actually a change from the first week to the second week. You had that as well. Yeah. You had to. So our game finished at about 9 o'clock because you had to go off after 10 overs and wipe your hands, and the ball had to get some sort of, you know, sanitizer wipes or whatever it was. And then you'd do it after 20 overs. And then, you know, one thing I've found quite handy is because the afternoon tea situation, which I was panicking about because that's one of the highlights of the day.
Yes.
You have to bring your own.
Well, why are you panicking about that?
Well, because I thoroughly enjoyed the afternoon tea, getting the plethora of different foods. But now you just bring your own. So you go to the bakery and just go crazy on the way to the game.
So what's on the table for you at halftime and the cricket these days?
Under normal circumstances or this year?
Now that you're going to the bakery by yourself, what's the fare that's on offer?
Well, I'm not really sure I should be saying, to be honest.
What happened last Saturday? How about that? We just go back to the most recent event.
I can't even remember. I know there was a donut involved. I actually think an apple cake as well.
An apple cake and a donut.
I think that might have been it. I know a pizza slice, you know, those pizza slice type operations.
Well, I was going to say that.
The first week with a custard scroll.
Yeah, custard scroll. Goodness me.
So it just depends on the bakery of choice because Baker's Delight, they don't really have great cakes and that sort of stuff. They're really more your traditional bakery type situation.
Well, your patisserie sort of.
Well, it's more they're really specialising in the bread, aren't they? And the rolls. You're not getting a chock jam donut from Baker's Delight, which I think's a real weak part of their setup. But each to their own. So you've got to sort of, if you're in an away game situation, you've got to then sort of assess the situation of where can you get to that local bakery that has the plethora of options. So I'm actually quite enjoying the challenge of this.
Well, there you go. So you don't need full buffet sort of situation from someone just to bring through half time.
Bring your own and don't share with
yourself.
Anybody.
Well, which is right up your alley. They're not sharing with anybody.
I'm not sharing food with anyone. They say, oh, gee, that's all right. Can I have a bit of that? No. You had your chance to get it yourself. So bad luck.
No, you've got the perfect out. Yeah, COVID safe.
Yes.
Can't share. COVID safe. No, that's good. That's good. Yeah, it's. I think there's been a real lack of intensity from my cricket team in regards to the lunch interval, the tea interval. Mm. Like normally there is the fare and the good setup that goes on. Now it's just, you know, someone will bring a cheesy mite or you know, a pizza scroll or something, and that's about it. There's no real intensity about it.
No.
There's no real energy about that getting into the room. It's just sort of what it is.
We can't go in the room. It's a little bit like lunch back at school, where you like you have your own and you might sit on the bench or whatever, or you might go to the canteen if you'd earned some money earlier in that day, and away you go. That was the great thing from my perspective. If I was back at school, I'd sell footy cards and footy stickers to the younger people, and whatever cash I made during the day, I'd then spend at the canteen. So sometimes I had some wonderful meals for lunch. Real hot meal setup if I'd managed to do some good deals during the recess.
Now, the Baker's offered to hook you up if you're playing in the Bayside area. No,
yes.
I'm not sure there's too many teams from the Warrandyte. What comp do you play, RDCA?
Ringwood District Cricket Association.
Yeah, it's not too many Bayside teams in the Ringwood District Cricket Association, is there?
No, we need to, back the old days of playing subbies and playing the Southern Division, and you'd have all sorts of options with Ormond and Brighton and the like. But what Wallace should do down there, which is what the Baker looks after, he should go and sponsor a team and actually bring a tray of goods.
COVID safe.
And just, COVID safe, just present them and then just disappear. Just leave them in the car park and someone can come pick it up.
Leave it in the car
park. And away
park.
They go. Anyway.
No, it's a different world. It's
now,
a different world.
I wanted to talking about cricket and talking about being COVID safe. There's an interesting story I think is developing in South Africa, because And the reason it's relevant to Australian cricket is that Australia is supposed to be playing South Africa in test matches come February and March.
Right.
And there's going to potentially be a choice for the Australian players. Do they go to New Zealand and play in a T20 environment where they don't have to quarantine the rules are a lot less strict because New Zealand and Australia are going very well with the virus at the moment. At South Africa, very different. And David Warner has signaled, well, maybe I might just play the T20s and not play the test matches because I'm sort of getting sick and tired of hotel quarantine, etc. And when you look at the situation in South Africa at the moment with England touring there at the moment, two members of the South African squad have tested positive for COVID since the squad assembled last week. I would describe that as a setback. For that particular series. It's a lot stricter what they're doing compared to, say, what you're doing with the AFLW setup at the moment. That's why I asked you the questions before about what they're doing because, you know, there are two groups and it's non-contact. So if two or a couple get tested positive, well, they can be then sort of removed from the group. But, you know, it's still, you know, we're doing really well here, but I just wonder what sort of implications that might have. If Australia and New Zealand particularly are essentially free of the virus, should South Africa come and play test matches here?
Well, the short answer is probably yes, isn't it?
I mean, I don't know.
I mean, that's the safest way to get it done and to get them to play cricket. And we've got the virus under control. Now, there's an SMS before from Kraz, I think it might have been. I'm not that smart, he says, but if nobody in the state has the virus, why do we have any restrictions at all? How are you going to catch it? Well, it's not to say it's not there. It's just not been identified.
The cases haven't been identified.
Yeah, haven't been identified at this stage from all and sundry who still may have it. And this is one of the things with the whole governance of the situation is the sewage testing is one of the best things they do. Because they can identify. It's fascinating. The whole thing's fascinating, I reckon. The sewage testing, you can identify which areas the virus still is present.
Yes.
Like it's amazing how they can do that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So from a Victorian perspective, traces were found, I shouldn't really say, just in case I get those wrong, but I think it was Benalla and in the Portland area, I think. This is going back about a week. There's... It would appear that there is the coronavirus is in society still, but it's just a question of the right people testing for it and for it to be picked up.
Yeah, because as we know, a lot of people are asymptomatic with that sort of stuff too, and you don't know you've got it, which is one of the challenges of the whole extravaganza. But it's not exactly gone. It's just not hasn't been identified just yet.
Can you imagine going to a party, or I wouldn't go to a party, but if you're just sort of somewhere and you get out here going, yeah, not too bad. Oh, yeah, what do you do? Yeah, oh, yeah, I sort of work on radio. Yeah, okay, what do you do? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm a sewage tester.
I test sewage.
Yeah.
I reckon there'd be a lot of pegs in the world. you'd be a real pegman for your schnoz. It's an interesting job title, but very important job title as well, just by the way.
Yeah,
but we digress. Sorry.
Yeah. So just back to that South African situation. It was always going to be a big talking point when Justin Langer said, don't like the fact that we're going to have two Australian teams essentially playing at the same time in international cricket, with short-form cricket being played against New Zealand and test matches being played against South Africa. Because clearly it's going to dilute the product, and clearly you're going to have players that you'd want in the T20 team that are in the test team. But now the choice might be, well, what's the safer option? Now, that would clearly... I think compromise the test series. And so you would have to ask questions as to whether, yes, okay, South Africa, it would be better for their economy and better for their potential crowds and TV and all that sort of thing for it to be played in South Africa. But if the Australian players aren't happy to go from a safety perspective, do they have to change the way that they look at what they would do? I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's interesting.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. But your point before, I mean, if you've got a team that's in a ravaged COVID country who wants to play cricket, and you've got two countries who are relatively close by that are handling the situation quite well, then why wouldn't you get them to come over and be a part of that summer? I mean, it makes sense in just about every aspect, doesn't it? There's not too many downsides. You wouldn't do the pros and cons of this and say, well, look at the list of cons. There wouldn't be too many.
I wouldn't have thought so.
We'll see. We'll see. Hey, did you see our man Merrick last night on SAS? Our man?
No, I didn't.
He got through.
Yeah, I know. I knew that.
Well, how did you know that? It wasn't until last night.
No, because I'd got some inside information.
Oh, so you're one of those types, eh?
Well, anyway, so explain what happened, because it's gone from me. I started watching it.
I was at training.
Oh, you didn't see it either.
I was at training. But our man Merrick got through. Nick Cummins, the Honey Badger, he got through. And Sabrina Frederick from the Tigers, she got through as well. So I had three who were successful in being selected for the SAS.
So you know Sabrina reasonably well because you've coached against her.
No, I've coached against her once. I don't know her at all.
Right, okay.
But
were you surprised at how well she went?
But, yeah, I'll go on to say, but she impressed the socks off me with how she carried herself and how she performed through the series. Super impressed I was with how she did it. She's a star. Apparently she's a great human, which is unsurprising. But what a competitor. Yeah, what a goer.
She's dropped half her name too. Remember she used to be Sabrina Frederick Traub?
Traub,
or something. And then she's dropped the... It's very rare. Drop half your surname.
It's not something I've done. Although, you probably could say that I have. I don't get the ud very often. Just half is what I go by. Call me half.
Or halfy, depending on who you're talking to. Or halves.
Halves, there's a few V's in there from people. There's no V in the name, just for those playing at home. There's no V in the name at all. But well done there, man, Merrick. I was pumped about that. We've got to get Jimmy on that.
I'm discouraging that.
I want to see Jimmy on SAS. I think he can do it.
I think there are components that Jimmy would do extremely well at. But, I think it's more your sort of thing.
Me?
What would be your story? Because we've talked, that it's about participating in the activities, and then there's the putting the hood on them and bringing them into the room and really interrogating them and sort of bringing up skeletons in the closet and all this sort of stuff. We start talking about things that happen in toilets and all sorts of other bits and pieces. What's your story that would really sort of... Nah. Because you need a storyline, Daniel. You can't just be good at the activities.
Nah, that's why it'll never happen. And that's why I wouldn't buy that, because I'm boring. I'm basically really boring. My world, boring. Everything's been okay. Not too many turmoils. I haven't been addicted to anything just yet. I haven't got any colourful background stories.
So you're a sort of a bringing together of people. You're a culture changer. But that's positive.
Need some juice. You need some dirt. There's just no dirt. I'm just boring. And that's okay. I've dealt with that. I've learned to deal with the fact that I'm just boring.
We talked about your sort of failed boy band type activity when you were still playing and that sort of stuff.
There's nothing failed about it. What are you talking about? I was a juggernaut in the musical industry at the time. What are you talking about, failed? How dare you?
Wow.
How very dare you?
That's going to be your issue, your lack of storyline. Producers aren't interested in whether you'll go really well at the challenges and whether you'll be, you'll be a good culture person and bring people together. We need a Faras, or we need a someone that has got, a Candace Warner type story that just captures the imagination of the tabloids.
What if I told them I used to open the batting with Glenn Luff? Would that be a colourful enough story for the producers to get me involved?
Well, I think you'd be struggling there.
Aaron Baines is now a Toronto Raptor. Now, the free agency period is in full swing, as we know. We've been discussing that for the last week or so. And he's found himself now at Toronto after a bit of time at Phoenix last season, and Boston, of course, before that. He's been good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning, Aaron.
G'day, fellas. How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Good on you, buddy. We appreciate your time. You are welcome anytime on the program. Two-year deal with the Raptors. Were you looking for this, or is this... We were talking about this before, Aaron, about the way that players are moved through the AFL free agency period. It's nothing compared to the US sporting scene. Does it just happen, or do you know much about it going into it?
So you have a few ideas going into it, but, you know, this is unlike anything else that's ever been for the free agency period in the NBA. You know, everything was condensed, and it was a mad dash and just craziness going on. So from the draft, it was probably, there was, I think, 36 hours from the time of the draft, and they're organizing trades, everyone's moving, and so things that were open kind of get taken away in trades, and other things start to open up, and then players making decisions on what teams are looking like and where they want to go, and everything was just nuts this year. So we kind of had plan A, B, C, D, and E, and by the end of the day, you know, everything changed, and it all got jumbled up. So it was interesting, it was stressful, and the biggest thing is a big shout out to my wife for putting up with me throughout the 48 hours plus of the beginning of free agency to when I signed. So I was definitely distant and glued to my phone because it was entertaining and stressful all at once.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. And I'd love to get a bit more of an insight into that shortly. But just as a layer of complication, your wife's due to give birth soon, is she not?
I figured, you know, we didn't have any other stresses going on in life, so might as well throw something else into the mix. But that was definitely a fail on planning for that one. But, yeah, we're excited nonetheless. Although we're trying to get out to Tampa Bay before the baby comes and have a Tampa baby, so... you know, we're running against the clock right now.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing story, and it's one of the well-told stories in the US where players have just moved around the country. In fact, not from your points, not around the country, not moving to another city. You're moving to another country, literally, in Toronto. How long does it take to get your head around the fact of all the things you need to do to get to Toronto and sort your life out from there?
So I mentioned it before, but with the COVID and international border closures, Toronto can't actually play out of Canada, so we're playing out of Tampa Bay this year.
Oh,
and so it's kind of interesting that I signed in Toronto. We're ready for a heavy winter, but now we're going down to Florida and we're spending a Florida winter. So, you know, for the foreseeable future, we're going to be down in Tampa Bay and playing out of there as our home base. So a little bit different than where I initially signed, but looking forward to it nonetheless.
Oh, my apologies. That's a fascinating part of the whole situation. And that's going to happen for the whole season. They've written Toronto as Canada as an option out. They're just going to play everything through the States.
Right now they have optimism that by March we'll be able to be flying in and out of Toronto again. However, everything that's gone, every plan you've had in 2020 has been changed anyway. So, you know, we'll plan for the worst and hope for the best that we can get to Toronto. However, we'll be setting up the family out there in Tampa Bay. And so, like I said, we're in the race against the clock to get the missus out before she delivers.
What's it like living in the US at the moment, Aaron?
Oh, mate, it's like day-to-day life. Everything's normal. You know, it's crazy compared to how it is the rest of the world. And then you come to America and everything's just normal day-to-day life. I mean, they were aware of COVID and they're aware of how infectious it is, but you couldn't tell it by going down to the local mall or going out to a restaurant, that's for sure, especially out here in Arizona.
Yeah, so from your perspective as a professional athlete, you've just had a season where you've essentially played a full year in a bubble. How sort of careful do you have to be just being a citizen as you are now off-season?
Yeah, so it comes with a lot of common sense things that, you know, well, it should be common sense nowadays anyway, just wearing a mask when you're out, sanitizing your hands. Unfortunately, we all tested positive for COVID in the early stages of it as a family, so I currently have the antibodies, my wife doesn't, so we're pretty protective of her right now, especially late-term pregnancy and anything that is out and about, that's my duties. I get to go out and do all the fun appointments with the kids or run around, and I've got to duck into the shop, so you know, it's an extra layer of protection that I do have antibodies. I'm pretty safe in that manner. But, yeah, with her, we're definitely very cautious and still wipe everything down. And she stays away from people for the most part. So kind of locked her up for this whole pregnancy, which, again, she's holding out against me as well.
Yeah, that's right. So explain to us about having... 'cause, I mean, here in Australia... so few people had it, and I shouldn't say past tense because it's still an issue, but you know, we were locked down here in Victoria for quite some time, and it's proven to be very successful. But for someone that's had it and then sort of living knowing you have had it, does it make you feel bulletproof? Or just explain a little bit about that whole process.
Definitely not bulletproof. Definitely feel that it is something pretty serious. You know, it kicked my butt. I was fortunate that the rest of my family were very asymptomatic. But for me, you know, it really took me out. I slept for a solid week. I think on day five, I saw back-to-back hours for the first time. I was wiped out. I was a bit of a struggle. So, you know, I was lucky that I'm on top of my diet and I'm fit, because that definitely helped me through and stopped it from getting any worse. But it's something that, yeah, we take pretty serious, and you never know when the antibodies will go, and it's something that, you know, we don't know what happens if you get it twice. So it could be even worse. And so knowing those things and how many unknowns there still are, we're very precautious about everything. We try and take as much care as we can. We're still socially distanced, but it's definitely not the norm over here.
Now, the summer of tennis, it's all going to be in Melbourne. It was going to be fantastic. All the tournaments here, getting ready for the Australian Open. We're not really sure what that looks like at the moment. I wonder what that feels like, how that sits with those trying to plan for it. Mark Pollmans is a young Aussie tennis gun who's hopefully planning for that and somehow having some direction in the build-up to it. He joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good on you, buddy. Great to have you with us. Now, what's it like trying to plan for a summer of tennis when you're not really sure what it looks like?
No, it's definitely a bit different to most years. You know, I'm stuck into my pre-season training now. But usually we know that the tournament schedule is going to start, you know, on the 1st of Jan. At the moment it's a bit up in the air, and there's talk that the AO might only be in February. So I'm still trying to train as best I can and prepare for potentially five sets. Not quite sure what the tournament schedule is looking at just yet. Yeah.
So who are you getting your information from? Because you're right. I mean, one of the latest bits of information going around for the Australian Open was that January 25 and Feb 1 are possible start dates, let alone what they were talking about last week, where it might get pushed back to March, depending on how it all looks. Who are you conversing with at Tennis Australia to find out the latest?
Yeah, so each week, Craig Tiley, he shoots us an email and lets us know the latest information. So it's coming from the very top, and he's working really hard, he says, about trying to, you know, get as many lead-up events as possible, and not just the AO. He's hoping not just to have just one event, hopefully a couple more lead-ups. Every week he's letting me know, and he's letting the other players potentially playing in the tournament know. So I think he's doing a great job. He's doing his best. So hopefully he can have some positive information for us on Friday.
How has it worked so far for you, Mark, in the lead-up to this situation at the moment? What sort of training have you been able to do? Has it been quite restricted, or at the moment are you a bit free with that?
I've been doing always my pre-season here in Melbourne at the NTC, so I'm very lucky. I can get used to the conditions and everything, how it's going to be in January. But at the moment, I haven't had any restrictions. I'm still allowed to practice there, and my coach can still come in there each day. Thankfully, all the cases and everything are nice and better here in Melbourne. So it's all good for training now.
And from your sort of pathway, Mark, I mean, obviously you've had a great year. The win in the French Open over a top 50 play, you had a win at the Australian Open. You're sort of making your way, and then you get to a point where you're just outside the top 100. You'd probably get into the main draw. You're sort of on the edge a little bit. Is that create some sort of anxiety, or how do you feel about that, not with all this unknown?
It's definitely a little bit of a stressful time, you know, when your ranking's around mine, because like you said, it's a bit of touch and go if you're going to slip into the main draw. So therefore I'll be either in the qualifying or relying on a main draw wildcard. So thankfully last year I was able to get one and get through my first round, but you never know what happens in this upcoming AO. I'm going to keep pushing towards the top 100, so I don't have to rely on playing on qualifying or relying on a wild card. So to hopefully next year I can make that push.
Yeah, so that was going to be my next question. When there's not very many tournaments being played, now usually you would have potentially, say, the AO Wildcard event, which is around about this time every year. You've got Brisbane. There's a couple of other events that you could potentially play to get some ranking points to get into that main draw without the special consideration. What have you sort of got any sort of feeling as to what events you might be able to play to get some ranking points?
Yeah, so I know that they're not going to be having the wildcard playoff. So, you know, usually I like to play some of those ATP events, like you said, Brisbane and also Adelaide International. I like to play those bigger 250s and you know, see where my level's at early in the season. But they did say they're going to be really aiming to have some challenges for the lower-ranked players. So if they don't have any of those 250s, but I think they're going to, I'm definitely going to be playing in the challenges. Hopefully they have one in Traralgon because I really did love playing there. Yeah.
Mark, you're in the US Open just a couple of months ago. So you've had a bit of an experience in a big tournament under these current situations. How was that experience for you? How was it different to what you might normally experience? And do you think that having, you know, being in that tournament can help you prepare for what might be to come for the Oz Open?
Yeah, for sure. You know, it was my second main draw in a Grand Slam, so I think it was really good experience for me. And you know, I ended up losing in 5 sets, so I took a lot from that match. I was very happy that I was able to play in the event. I was thankful to have the tournament, and to be in the main draw was an added bonus. But definitely, I think that that match really helped me, you know, to have a bit more belief when I played in the French Open a few months later. So I think all that experience is going to help me, hopefully, the AO next year. Yep.
How many weeks on the road have you spent this year? Because obviously with the schedule not being as compressed or as many tournaments as Whitey was saying before, how much time have you spent overseas this year compared to a normal year?
Yeah, I just got back last Friday from 3.5 months overseas. But that's kind of normal for me. I usually go for that long minimum. But I also did 3 months at the start of the year as well. And then when COVID hit, I was in Indian Wells preparing for the 1000, and that's when they shut all tournaments and I came home after that. It's been 3.5 months and I got back last week.
Yeah. Mark, when you look at what might be the quarantine period or the lead into this Oz Open, obviously we don't know exactly what that is going to look like, but if there are some athletes who are in that quarantine and maybe restricted in terms of training, is your information at the moment that's the conditions you'll be under, or will it be different because you've been here in Melbourne and you'll have a bit more freedom?
Yes. So I've done my 2 weeks now quarantine, so I'm free to move around as much as I want. But you know, I don't have to go. They'll be having a bubble here, so they'll be having players that have to quarantine. So I won't have to go into there, or there'll be no restrictions for me. There'll be obviously restrictions for those players that come here and have to, you know, do their time and wait. So it's perfect for me now. I can just train and I don't have to worry about any restrictions. Yeah.
Speaking of active, not too many more active people on the planet than Kieran Harrington, the Carlton co-captain in the AFLW. She's getting ready for a big season 2021 and she joins us on the line. Good morning, Kez.
Good morning, Daniel. A nice early start after a fairly big session last night.
Yes. Well, you're a top-level performer, so there's no doubt that's not going to be an issue for you. But just on that, getting back into it after a big break through the season, has your body reacted differently this time around?
I haven't really thought about that. No, I don't think so. We put a lot of work in over the isolation period, which wasn't too much fun, as I'm sure you can attest to, you know, cutting laps and those sort of things. I certainly pulled up very sore after the first contact session. You know, you knew you'd been tackled the night before when you woke up the next morning. But apart from that, no, I don't think so. I think I'm tracking pretty well, and most of the girls are too.
Well, Kieran, that's the physical side of things. Obviously, getting the group together, you know, I've had that experience with netball. It was kind of like amazing, but also slightly weird, kind of being around each other and getting back into that training environment. How have you felt that, just getting back into things and the contact side of it?
Yeah, it was almost a strange feeling going back into the club that night. Everyone, you know, kind of wasn't really sure how to act or behave given, you know, what had sort of happened the last 6 months. That dissipated pretty quickly, and within about 5 minutes, it was just, you know, a whole heap of love that was just floating around the room. It was really nice just to be back, you know, with the girls, and there wasn't too much footy chat for those first couple of weeks. It was just, you know, checking in on everyone, making sure everyone was you know, doing okay after such a long time away from each other. And, you know, once that novelty wore off, and then we got back into the footy. So it's been really great, actually. And I think, like myself, most of the girls have just appreciated being back around people that they really enjoy spending time with, and starting to work towards something hopefully pretty special.
Now, Taylor Harris did some media yesterday, and she talked about the fact that you're going to be dangerous this year as a team. Now, I've already posed that question to Daniel as to what dangerous means. What does dangerous mean?
Well, when you're considering Taylor Harris, dangerous means standing about 2 metres in front of her as the ball's coming
yeah,
in.
Yeah, that's right.
Ready to be absolutely crunched. That's what I consider dangerous.
Correct.
look, I mean, Tay's right. You know, we've been building, you know, a pretty consistent program now for the last 2 years. And I think that we've now got the experience from obviously both a personnel point of view, but also game experience in big moments where, you know, I think we're ready to really have a good tilt at the flag this year. So, you know, it's November, which means that we're only focused on one team, and that's us at the moment. I've got no idea what anyone else is doing. And quite frankly, at this point of the year, we don't really care what anyone else is doing. We're just concentrating on us and getting ourselves ready. And, you know, the ball's zipping around pretty well at training at the moment, much better than perhaps what it's been, you know, this time in previous years. Just shows a real hunger from the group and, you know, put the work in, you know, over the last sort of 6 months on our own to prepare it, you know, ourselves and get ready to hopefully have a real crack.
So how do you feel about how it finished up last year? Because you were one of four teams that had a chance at winning the premiership before it was all sort of shut down. And, I mean, the AFL has come out and since said we probably did the wrong thing there. Is there a bit of unfinished business, a bit of chip on the shoulder sort of stuff that we've got to make sure that we, you know, sort of not make up for what happened last year, but that there's a bit of anger in the camp that you didn't get to potentially win a premiership last year?
Look, I don't think I'd describe it as anger. I mean, certainly disappointment, you know, the way that we were building, you know, into that prelim final. You know, obviously it takes a lot of work and a lot of sacrifice to have the opportunity to play in those sort of games. So, certainly disappointment. The focus shifted really quickly. You know, obviously we played the game on Sunday night against the Lions. We got up, which meant that we were, you know, eligible for the prelim final the following week. And within about an hour of the game finishing, I think the enormity of the situation, you know, just in society kind of hit all the players. And as much as football is a huge priority for us, there's so many other priorities, you know, obviously work and employment and families and those sort of things. So the focus was really quickly shifted to, I guess, more survival mode than worrying about football, if that makes sense. What that meant, though, was obviously coming back this year, the girls have got, as you said, probably a chip on their shoulder, but more about, you know, wanting an opportunity to actually win one. So if you think 2 seasons ago, we went over to Adelaide in that grand final and quite frankly got, you know, basically our pants pulled down by them. They were an unbelievably good team and, you know, much better team on the day than us. We back up the following year, you know, we put ourselves in a position again where we were able to really contend for the flag, and through, you know, no fault of our own and completely out of our control, that opportunity was taken away from us. So the group has come back, absolutely raring and ready to go, just for an opportunity. And we're also, I guess, pretty thankful at the moment and grateful for the opportunity that we've got back training and preparing to play, because there's not too many sports at the moment that are doing that. So, probably more disappointment than anything else.
And when you look forward to this season, Karen, you the co-captain with Katie Loynes, how do you manage that captaincy? How do you manage that kind of official leadership role? And I know we were talking to Harf a little bit earlier about the, in some ways, disjointed, you know, meetings have to be separated. Some of the trainings are still in small groups. What's your leadership going to be like throughout this possibly challenging time?
Yeah, look, I mean, Katie and I are both really fortunate that the group, the leadership group that we've got around us, so at the moment there's four nominated leaders in our, I guess, titled leadership group. And, you know, we've all been, I guess, split up into the different groups that we've been training in for the last couple of weeks. So there's been a really good spread of leadership amongst amongst all of the different smaller groups, which has been really, really helpful because for a few weeks there, you know, we drafted in two or three different players who I, you know, had really just introduced myself to, and that's all I had to do with them for the first couple of weeks, which, you know, I guess in a way was challenging from our point of view because we wanted to embrace them and bring them into the group and bring them up to speed. But also for them probably was a good thing because instead of being sort of, you know, I guess hit with 29 new faces, they got to know 9 or 10 quite closely and then, you know, were able to expand and open up to the rest of the group. So, yeah, look, no doubt it's been a challenging time. I think the challenge for Katie and I was just to make sure that, you know, we were kind of across, you know, what was going on with everyone and, you know, just making sure that, you know, everyone was on the same page and coping, I guess, outside of football as much as anything else. And then once we got back into footy, it was that ability for us to kind of, I guess, switch into gear as quickly as we can. But one of the things that we sort of spoke about and allowed the group to do was just to have a bit of time to transition back in. And, you know, we had an unofficial pre-season with what we were calling it, where we were, you know, back in the club. And the whole purpose of us being there was just to kind of re-engage with each other and, you know, talk things, not football for a while and, have a bit of a laugh with our mates. And then, you know, once that sort of pre-season date hit, it was like, hey, here we go, you know, kind of switch back into gear. So certainly been a challenging time, but I think thankfully for Katie and I, you know, obviously we work really well together. We're quite different leaders, as I'm sure half would agree with, but I think the differences in our leadership complement each other quite nicely. And yeah, as I said, the group that we've got around us supporting us has been just a yeah, tremendous support for both us and also for the rest of the group.
And we know the Australian women's cricket team is the best team on the planet. That's a given. They won the T20 World Cup back in February, was it March? A long time ago, back at the MCG when life was almost normal. And we know that they are loved by the Australian sporting public because some True North emotional connection research has come out. And they're the number one ranked sporting team in the nation. I'm sure, as coach of that team, Matthew Mott's very proud of that. He joined us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Matthew.
Morning, guys. How are you?
Going very well, thank you. Now, you've had a lot of titles and accolades thrown your way in recent times, and you've earned them through your sporting endeavours with the girls. But when you get this level of recognition from the Australian sporting public, what does that mean to you and the team?
Yeah, it means a lot. I think you know, we all love playing the game, and something we talk a lot within our team is being connected to our grassroots and the people that we grew up around. And how we got a lot of love for playing the game. I think that comes across. And the way I think we play well on the field and we've won a lot. But I think what resonates most with people is most of the players, for the large part of it, play with a smile on their face. And they're real, they're normal. They've all gone through very different journeys. But I think there's a real authenticity about the way that they conduct themselves. And I think that's probably why the team got the award.
I totally agree with that, Matthew. But for me, it's also, I was at the MCG watching the World Cup final and watching the girls do amazing things. And it just made me think, you know, as I was a young girl growing up, I didn't get to see females do that. I didn't get to watch them playing sport at the elite level much, only really small snippets of it. But my young daughter was watching over the fence. And I thought, what an amazing, you know, childhood and growing up for her to see people and women doing this as more of a natural thing. Do you guys feel the weight of that and how special and important that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, a lot of my family was there that day. And, my sisters said the same thing. You know, they watched the game. They had goosebumps watching female athletes go out there in front of, you know, 90,000 people and show what they can do. And I think the lucky thing about cricket is it's not an overnight success. And I think we've got a proud history within the country. But now, you know, the Meg Lannings and that grew up and probably didn't know the Belinda Clarks and the Karen Roltons because they didn't see them. The next generation, and you say young girls, but my 12-year-old boy was there and he doesn't see gender anymore. He just sees, and you know, the BBL is a classic example. He'll just say the Sixers are playing and stuff like that. So it's not about male, female anymore. And I'd like to think there was just as many young boys inspired that night as there was young girls. And that's such a great place to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. My son was one of those as well.
Yeah, I think I think that's absolutely spot on. I'm just interested in what you thought of the WBBL. There's been a lot of cricket played over the last sort of 5 or 6 weeks. We've reached the finals. As an observer watching your guys go about it, how did you think they all went?
Yeah, incredibly well. And I just think everyone in Australian cricket needs a lot of credit for getting that up and running. There was times where we just thought it was going to be too hard with all the restrictions on there. But right inside Cricket Australia, in states, everyone worked tirelessly just to get the game up and running. And we've got a bit of an internal saying at the moment, is just tie it up with wire to keep the show on the road. And I think that's been the theme for the whole thing. And that's what the players did. It wasn't pretty at times. I think the start of the tournament was quite wet and we missed a lot of cricket. But the standard of cricket towards the back end has been nothing short of exceptional. And it's a credit to all those people. Have been some of our players that started that New Zealand series a couple of months ago have been in pretty tight lockdown for a long time. So I've just got ultimate respect for everyone who's got through it. I think the best teams are in the finals from what I've seen from the outside. And hopefully some individuals step up. But aside from our players doing well, it's been really, really great to see some young players put their hand up and show what they can do as well.
And one of those I've paid particular attention to is Darcy Brown, who's bowled for the Strikers. She bowls some real heat, and she's only 17 years of age. Is this what we're seeing coming through, Matty?
It is. It's exactly what we're seeing. I think, as you said, now this team's been pretty successful and visible for the last few years, and I think that we're starting to get the pick of the best athletes getting attracted to the game, and that's something we've always desired. But you know, Darcy Brown's definitely an excitement machine. She seems mature beyond her years. She runs in and hits a hard length, and no doubt she's probably been inspired by someone like Taylor Vlaminck in the last couple of years that's come through and onto the bowl fast. And I think that's the next frontier for women's cricket. I think the batting and the fielding's really come of age in the last couple of years, and the bowling's just been simmering away. And when players like that start coming through, I genuinely think it's going to be exciting over the next 3 to 5 years to see what comes through.
Time for our RSN Legends series to continue today. And we're on the eve of an Indian summer, so to speak. And the world of cricket is going to continue. We're going to have the Indians here, who are one of the most formidable teams on the planet. And one man who debuted against the Indians in 1985-86 went on to play 53 tests for Australia and score 1,000 runs. That's just with the bat, of course. So 212 wickets, 33 one-days, 100 runs on the dot with 38 wickets, and one of the most fabulous moustaches in the history of sport across the globe. It's the one and only Merv Hughes, who joins us on the Legend Series. Good morning, Swervin.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
We are very, very well. Now, when I talk about that, the Indians coming across and your debut against the Indians in 1985-86, what floods back to your memory?
Probably at the end of the game, the biggest thought I ever had, will I ever play another test match? 123, a fifth ball duck and a couple of drop catches. It wasn't a great debut in test cricket, but obviously got the opportunity to play. And probably for me was just the step up. I mean, all cricket games, it doesn't matter what level you play, is bat, bowl and field, but the margin for error to international batsmen is slight. And we came up against Sunil Gavaskar, who made 160 not out in that game. And just bowling to him, dead set did my brain. It was just very, very hard work. And realised when I finished that game that you had to improve and had to step up a little bit more.
It's one of the things they talk about a lot, from state teams to, definitely in terms of cricket, state teams to international teams, where you might be one or two really good players in the state team, but when you get to the international level, they're all awesome, and you've got no idea until you get there that what it looks like. Is that what you found?
Yeah, pretty much. I'd had a pretty good education through my first club cricket. We had Ron Gaunt, who was an ex-international, that was a bowling coach down there, and we had Ken Eastwood, who played one test match but played a lot of cricket for Victoria, and had Lindsay James, who was an outstanding coach, and then got into the Victorian team, and Ian Redpath had taken over, and he brought in Alan Connolly and Keith Stackpole. And what they did, they prepared us to play hard-fought first-class cricket and tried to prepare us for test cricket, but basically, you find out that there's just no preparation. You're thrown in at the deep end, and now there's not too many blokes that just take it by the horns and run with it. So yeah, had a tough debut, and probably Ian Cullen, former Victorian fast bowler, played a fair bit of cricket with him, and he summed it up pretty easily in one sentence to me. He said the difference between test cricket, state cricket, club cricket is in club cricket, you can bowl a bad ball every over and get away with it. At state cricket, you can bowl a bad ball every couple of overs and get away with it. At international cricket, every bad ball you hit, your bowl gets hit. So those words were sort of echoing in my ears when I was halfway through my first bowling style. Just anything just a little bit over pitched, a little bit wider, a little bit short, just got absolutely met by the Indians. And it was a tough debut.
So, Merv, you'd sort of played 4 or 5 years of Victorian cricket before you got your chance at international cricket. Were you close for a while? Take us through the selection process when it finally took place.
I'd had a probably injury hit 5 years, to be honest. So I played the back half of 1 year. Then I played the first half of the next year, was out for the back half through injury. I probably knew I was getting close. 1983, they had this thing, used to be an SO scholarship. So 4 young players each year got picked from Australia to go over to the UK and play, and had the opportunity with that. The other 3 my year were Robbie Kerr from Queensland, Mike Hazen from South Australia, and Greg Matthews from New South Wales. So that was probably an early sort of indication that the selectors had identified you as possibly being up to the standard. So that gave me a lot of hope. And to go over to England, I played for Essex Seconds, and Mike Dennis, the former English captain, was captain of the second 11, and he was absolutely fantastic. So all along the way, I've just really had good, strong leadership and really intelligent sort of guys at the helm to lead in the right direction.
And sort of, I mean, obviously throughout your entire time with Australia, but you seem to have a really close relationship with Alan Border, and he really backed you in, and you became such an integral part of that team. How did that relationship develop?
Oh, it didn't start too well, I've got to be honest. when I first got in the side, a little bit of nervous energy, I suppose, and Alan Border was the one that nicknamed me Fruit Fly, because he said I was Australia's biggest pest. I think that was about 15 minutes into having sort of spent time with him at training and that. Alan Border was fantastic. It was at the time he was under a fair bit of pressure too. He'd just taken on the captaincy. We'd lost a heap of more experienced and senior blokes to the Rebel Cool to South Africa. And Alan Border was fantastic. He copped a lot of criticism from the media for being unsure and unsupportive on the ground. But, mate, we knew as players exactly what was expected from us. AB used to talk to us before the day's play, at drinks, during the break. He'd never make a big deal about anything. If you're going bad, he never made a big deal about it on the ground. He'd just pull you aside and have a bit of a chat about what you're doing wrong and possibly what you could do to turn it around. So, as I said, to have great leadership, it just makes it easier. And Bob Simpson, my first test match was his first test match as coach. And as I said, Alan Border had just taken over, and AB just threw into a fantastic captain.
You were an energetic cricketer, Merv. You're a great competitor, as anyone who watched you play would attest to. Did anyone try and curtail that or rein that in when you got to the national level, that you may have been going over the top?
No, not really. I was always told and express yourself as a kid. So if you're having a good time, let it be known. So you probably, it didn't really shine through the first couple of years I played because of the nerves, because of the uncertainty of being there. I really didn't feel secure in the Australian side to even probably halfway through the 89 tour to England. So I was in and out of sides, got picked for England in 89 and probably wasn't going to play too much, and Carl Rackerman got injured. So the opportunity opened for myself, and I suppose it was between Greg Campbell and myself. And I got a few wickets in that first test match, and We only used the 12 players throughout that series, so to be on the sidelines would have been hard. So if you missed that first test match, it was going to be really hard to get in because the team did so well. So I had the opportunity, and to have Terry Alderman and Jeff Lawson in England in 89, they played a lot of cricket in England, and especially Terry Alderman, but take nothing away from Jeff Lawson. They were very helpful for me over in England 89, just a young buck learning off the old bulls. It was fantastic.
And that series was one of my favourites of all time, that 89 Ashes series. Was that the signalling of the start of the dominant era for Australian cricket, do you think?
I think the start half actually happened 2 years before it. And to be honest, 4 years before. So 1985, when Bob Simpson was appointed coach, Alan Border was appointed captain, and a bloke by the name of Laurie Sewell from West Australia was appointed chairman of selectors. And they just, probably, I reckon their motto would have been short-term pain, long-term gain. It was, you know, if you could bat and bowl, that's great, but everyone at that level can. What you've got to do is bring more to the table. So what they tried to do, and Bob Simpson's plan was to make us the best fielding team in world cricket. And that started to sort of shine through in 87 when Australia, and I wasn't part of that, the World Cup in India, Pakistan, they won that. But our test results had sort of turned around. We weren't being beaten 3-0 in test series. We were being beaten 2-1 or 1-0. And a lot of people sit back and say, well, that doesn't make any difference. And the thing about test cricket is if you're not good enough to win, you can be good enough to stop the other team from winning. And if you can do that, you're on your way to being a pretty good side. And certainly if you have a look at the results from the time Alan Border and Bob Simpson were appointed to 1989, so 4 year period, we just slowly turned it around without having that, I suppose, satisfaction of winning. But certainly in 89, I suppose all the moons aligned. We got Terry Alderman, Carl Rackman and Trevor Holmes back. Went over to England. Alan Border played over there for a while. Most of the team had been together for about 4 years, so we were just starting to grow in confidence. And just all clicked. Terry Alderman was outstanding. Jeff Lawson took a heap of wickets. Mark Taylor, Steve Waugh made a heap of runs, and we're on our way.
Merv, you talked earlier about bowling to Sonny Gavaskar in your first game. When you look back on your career, who was the one guy that you didn't want to have to bowl to?
Adam, I love bowling against the best. So I suppose any sportsman, it doesn't matter what sport you play, you pit yourself against the best. So to shy away from a situation was just wasn't on, I suppose. But probably early doors, I had a few problems with a South Australian left-hander by the name of David Hook. And I look back as a young bloke and think, well, I probably wasn't the only one that had a little bit of trouble with him. And he taught me a lot of valuable lessons about overcoming probably a little bit of anxiety, because he certainly got hold of me the first couple of times we played against him. And then to come up against him year after year, you just had to find a way. And if you sort of backed off and tried to shy away from it, it didn't help the situation. So you just had to work it out. But Sonny Gavaskar was a fantastic player. Viv Richards, early in my career, for two different reasons. Viv was very attacking, and Sonny Gavaskar was a death by a thousand cuts. Just used the bat for a long time and wear the opposition down. And then later in my career, no surprises with Brian Lara and Sachin Tendulkar. They were fantastic young players. But Michael Atherton was probably the toughest competitor that I played against. He was fantastic for England when England were going not so well against Australia.
Right, okay. Now, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, about there was a particular game at the MCG late in the day where you took three top-order West Indian wickets, and there were some big names. Richie Richardson was part of all of that. But I just want you to share with our listeners that feeling of playing at the MCG and having that crowd behind you, because you were such an iconic figure, whether it be fielding down at fine leg or coming into bowl at the MCG. What was that feeling like?
Oh, no better place to play, to be honest. And we used to have these discussions with the New South Wales boys about the best ground in Australia. And they used to say, of course, the SCG, and we used to say the MCG. And the conversation was always cut short when you just point out to them that if they were happy playing in front of 42,000 people, so be it. But if you want to play in front of a big crowd, come to the MCG. So that used to shut them up a bit. But, I've always maintained there was only one thing better than being in the Australian side playing at the MCG, and that was being a Victorian in the Australian side playing at the MCG. The support that we got from our home base crowd, and it was no different. If we went up to Brisbane and Alan Border hit a four, the applause would be just a little bit more because of him being a Queenslander. Mark and Steve Wall, Mark Taylor hit a boundary, or Jeff Lawson got a wicket in Sydney, the roar would just be a little bit higher. So everywhere you went, you had that sort of state, I suppose, bias. And you come to Victoria, and when we're playing, whether it was a day-night match in front of 60,000, 70,000 people or Boxing Day in front of 80,000 people, the support that we got as Victorians was absolutely fantastic, and can't fault the Victorian guys, and especially all my mates in Bay 13, to go down and field in front of Bay 13 and the support that I got from down there. I mean, that was my demographic, wasn't it? Just guys down there on the field. And that's where I would have been if I hadn't been playing, I suppose.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.